Now, how many of you parents have had that type of experience in the past? Yeah. All right, let's be honest here. How many of you, if we went back to the archives of your parents' videos, how many of us would be guilty of something like that at some point at a birthday or a Christmas? We opened up something, didn't quite get what we were wanting. I started the series this month, All I Want for Christmas. And I've got specific things I want to focus on in the scriptures, but there are times when we do receive a gift and we open it up and we had expectation, but what was in the box wasn't quite what we were wanting. Maybe it was what we were needing. I mean, maybe you're one of those couples that, you know, the wife hints around a little bit what she wants, and the husband never gets it year after year, and finally you just tell him, look, I want these kind of boots, this kind of color, this size, from this store. Just go buy it. And on the way to the store, the husband gets a creative and says, no, this year I'm really going to surprise her. I'm going to think outside the shoebox. So he goes and gets something, and you know, and at Christmas she sees the box there. It's about the right size, about the right weight, and she opens it up, and it's a box of Nutrisystem or something, all right? Or the husband gets the box he'd been asking for, and a new iPhone or something, opens it up, it's the right size, right weight, and then pulls it open, and it's nose hair clippers or something. There are some times when we have high expectations, but when we get involved, it's just not what we were wanting. I know it's a celebratory time at Christmas. You know, people are anticipating times with family, friends, some time off from work. But I know it's also a difficult time for many. You know, we're closing up 2016. And when we opened the box of 2016, you had some expectations, some anticipations of good things. And it didn't turn out exactly like you thought. You know, some were hoping to have a new baby at the Christmas time this year. And it infertility or the adoption fell through, or perhaps a miscarriage, and they're not going to have that child this year that they thought. Now, I'm thankful today I can announce that, you know, Scott and Marcy Bowden had their baby this week. Isn't that exciting? They had it in a different way than expected. She had it in her bathroom floor rather than going to the hospital early enough, but it worked out. The baby's healthy. Mom's doing great. There are some who opened up the box of 2016 and thought, well, you know, I'm making some advancements. There's some promotions potential at work. It's going to be great. But then they started downsizing. Things got slow and people lost their jobs. Not quite what you expected when you opened the box. There are a lot of other things in our lives. Some will have an empty chair this Christmas that was filled last Christmas. A death of a loved one, and it's hard during Christmas, especially in those early months and years. When that individual's not there anymore, you can't hear their laughter and interact with them. And so, while everybody else is celebrating, you've got a heavy heart because of some things. There were some that opened up this year, said, you know, I'm gonna eat right, I'm gonna lose weight, I'm gonna focus on you know, taking my vitamins, and I'm gonna do everything right. And some of you have succeeded, yay. But then there was a car wreck, or there was a virus that got you down, or there were some surgeries that took place this year. And it set you back, and you weren't quite prepared for that. Even the recovery of, you know, some has taken longer than anticipated. And what you thought was going to be promoting some better health ended up not being that way when you opened the box. And so we get just like some of these kids displayed. Even though adults somehow disguise their disappointments better, still very much real. It's there. Some of you today, as you walk out, you'll go to your car, you'll look around at people of all ages, married couples that are holding hands. You know, some of the sweetest couples in this room are a lot older than I am, and it's still sweet that they snuggle, and even in the pew, I've seen some pictures where they'll hold hands and they'll be, you know, 80-year-old just back there snuggling together. It's just great. But when you walk to your car, you're alone. Your spouse has passed on, or there's been a divorce that's happened, or you're just single, and it's tough. Everybody else has someone to go home with, and you go home to four walls. Christmas isn't always exciting. I mean, that's not necessarily what you were expecting, but it's the box that you opened, and that's what you discovered. So when we talk about Christmas and talking about the gifts that he gives, there are some things that are universal for all who will trust in Christ. And that's what I want to focus on. Today I want to focus on the gift of hope. Hope that we all have. Now, I want us to read together Romans chapter 15, verse 13, because it's my wife's favorite verse, I think. She quotes it quite often. But would you read this out loud with me, Romans 15, 13? May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope. I don't know where you are this morning, but I know, I'm confident, because I know most of you, you're not abounding in hope. You're not overflowing with the joy that is of this season. It's just a struggle. So my prayer for you is that you would reconnect with who God is in your life and the hope that he has for you. And if you're not struggling today, I mean, it's a joyous time. Things are going well. Be thankful because the hope is beginning to be exposed in your life. But there may become a time in 2017 that you're not expecting, and you'll need this very message in your life. Where I'm going to go this morning, though, is not stay in Romans. I want us to go back to an Old Testament story of someone who lost everything, and how desperately they needed hope but didn't see it early on. They desired the best. They opened the box of their life, but they found it broken. I want you to turn to Ruth. The book of Ruth, if you know, you can find that in the Old Testament. It's before what's next to Judges. Page 222 in the Pew Bible, if you need to use the Pew Bible in front of you. And if you don't have a Bible, by the way, I try to say this every week if I can remember, take that Bible with you. It can be a gift to you. I'd rather that Bible be in your home being used than collecting dust here if you don't have a Bible. But as we turn to the book of Ruth, I want to just go over this just a few things in this book that I think will be helpful to us to understand the gift of hope. And it may seem obscure now, but it really does connect with the Christmas story. The book of Ruth begins in an era of the judges. They were ruling. They hadn't established kings yet. That would come later in time. There was a major famine in the land. And in the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verse 2, it says this. The name of the man, there was a famine in the land, so a man was going to have to move his family, or he thought he needed to move his family outside of the land where there was a famine and to go find some food. Not everybody in the community did this, but this family did. And in verse 2 it says, the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. About 4 or 5 years ago, I think, I did a whole sermon series verse by verse through the book of Ruth, and you can find that online if you're interested to find out more about that. But so you've got this family they have some struggles. It's just difficult. How are we going to feed our family? It's going to be tight in this community with the food. So he believes that he needs to move away to find a place of protection, a provision. Now, the names of these individuals are very interesting. Elimelech, his name means, my God is king. But here he's not trusting God as king to stay in the promised land. He decides to move outside the promised land. They're going to move to a foreign land where they worship foreign gods. So he doesn't really live up to his name. But I understand he's looking for provision, but I think he's looking to solve his own problems versus just trusting in God. Then you have Naomi, his wife. Her name means this, pleasant or sweet. She's a sweet woman. She's very pleasant to be around. Now that's interesting. You'll see something later how she wants to change her name. All right, Mahlon. His name means sick. His brother's name means dying or wasting away. What kind of sweet woman would name her children this? I don't know. It's kind of like, here's my son, bird flu. Here's my other one, cancer. I mean, how do you introduce your kids like that? But that's what their names meant. So here's the family. Well, they move. You know, I'll just kind of shorten the story up. They move to this new land. Things aren't much better there, but a little better. The boys are growing up. They find a couple of wives from the foreign land that do not worship the true God. And then tragedy strikes. Verse 3, Naomi's husband, Elimelech, dies. And then by verse 5, both adult sons had died. It's interesting that where Elimelech thought he was running from the problem to solve it, He actually ran into problems when he left. Jesus said this in Matthew chapter 16, verse 25. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. There is something that's true about that for every one of us. When we find ourselves in struggle, don't run from God's promised areas. Run to him. Embrace him. Hope is not living on our own apart from him, intermixing with other religions, but focusing on Christ alone. So what do we have here now? Four people moved, they married two more into the family, but now every male in that family is dead, and now you have a mother and two daughters-in-law, and they're grieving, all sharing the same box of Kleenex. We've lost our husbands. This is not a joyous time. What are we going to do? This is sad. Naomi decides that she's going to move back to her homeland. I need to go back to the promised land. I need to go back to Bethlehem, where I'm from. And so as she begins to depart, the two daughters-in-law want to follow her. She stops. She says this to them in verse 8. She says, go. Girls, I love you, but go. Return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And it said in verse 16. Verse 9. Let's go back up to verse 9. The Lord grant that you find rest, each of you, in the house of your husband. Meaning you'll have somebody in the future. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. I mean, it's so sad. They're all in mourning and grief. She says, just go back to your families. You can't go back to the promised land with me. It's not going to be any helpful to you. Well, both of them said they were going to go, but one of them did decide, okay, I'm going to take your instruction. I'm going to go back. And that was Orpah. There was Ruth and there was Orpah. Orpah decides to go back to her family. But Ruth, she has a different perspective. She's experienced the love of God through her mother-in-law. And this is what she says in verse 16. Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. In verse 17. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you. You see the love of this daughter-in-law for her mother-in-law? I mean, they've gone through some difficult times together. I can just imagine, the crying sessions they had together and talking about through all of these things they both lost, and now they're sad. But Ruth says, I've watched you, and I've been around you, and I don't want to be anywhere but with you. Now, how many of you have ever heard that verse before? You know, where you go, I'll go. You know, oftentimes they'll use that at a wedding. You know, I've been a part of weddings. We haven't necessarily used it at the weddings I've led, but I've sat in weddings. I've heard the pastor read the verses, and it's indicating that, you know, the husband or the wife is, you know, where you go, I'll go, and I'm going to be with you until the day we die. But if we look at the context of this, and that's a good application for it, but if we look at the context, it has nothing to do with a husband and a wife. It has to do with a mother and a daughter-in-law. I propose at my next wedding, we're going to read this, and I'm going to have the bride look back to her mother-in-law during the service and say these precious words, where you go, I'll go. Wherever you lie, I'll be there. And when you die, I'm going to die with you. You think that'll work? Perhaps that's in other cultures. I don't know if it'd work here, but I don't know. I'll propose it to the couple. Doing a wedding actually next year we've already planned for. So anyway, just very interesting, the level of connection and love here in the time of what seems to be grieving loss that is unsurmountable. Insurmountable. This is a difficult time. So now Ruth and Naomi return to Naomi's hometown of Bethlehem. That's the first clue that this is connected to the Christ birth story. At this time, Bethlehem has about 200 people. I want you to look around here. There, I don't know what the attendance is today, but it usually hovers around 200, maybe just a little south of that. So Bethlehem has about 200 people. When Ruth comes back, or when Naomi comes back after many years being away, do you think anybody would notice? Absolutely. They knew her. I mean, this is sweet, pleasant Naomi, who went away with her two young boys, and now she's coming back, and she's going to have to report that her husband is now dead, and she's going to have to report that her boys have both died. They were sick and wasting away. And now she's back, and she's not holding her head high, and so they're all gathered around her. Is it really her? I mean, what's going on? I mean, tell us what's been happening over the last 10, 15, 20 years that you've been gone. Let us know. Well, she says this as we kind of walk through this book in verse 20. She says, "Do not call me Naomi." Now, what does Naomi mean? Sweet or pleasant. Don't call me that. Call me Mara, which means bitter. Angry. Oh, incredible sense of depression and just frustration. Call me bitter. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty." She's much older now than she was when she left. And basically, as she's coming back now, she's not coming back with joy in her heart. She's not coming back with hope. She's not coming back with peace. She's not coming back with love. She's coming back with bitterness. "I went away thinking everything was great. Now I'm coming back to the homeland. I need to be here. I mean, there's no welfare program where we were just living. And I thought at least the 200 of you might love me enough to help me in this time of being a widow." And she says, "Don't call me pleasant. Don't call me sweet. Call me bitter. I'm a bitter old woman." Now, that's not the Naomi we typically talk about. But that's what she saw her life as, and she wanted everybody to call her that. Because she's hurting. Perhaps you've been hurting, or you know of somebody like that that's just been hurting, and you don't know what to do with the pain, and there's no words that can take it away. And that's what's happening here with Naomi. She doesn't see a future and a hope. How can you talk about Christmas when there's so much hurt? And here's the question I have for you. Does the story have to be about loss? Does the story have to end here? We close chapter 1 and say, well, that's it. So, I mean, she went with the best and came back with the worst. She opened the box of future, and all she found was difficulty and separation and loss, devastation. Well, if you know anything about the book of Ruth, it has four chapters. It's still very small, but four chapters, and all we've covered is one chapter. And I think the truth of that is sometimes when we're in the midst of the worst part of our life, we think we're at the end of our life, and we're only in the first chapter. God has several chapters to go. He's not done with you. Don't give up before God gives up. And everything that we know about God is He doesn't give up. He still has His plan. The sun will rise tomorrow by His great command. The stars will still shine because He calls them out by name. And He says, "Shine," and they do. Don't quit because God hasn't quit. God is what gives us hope. You can't run from Him. And so as she goes back, she's sad, but it's not the end. It was Jerry Sitzer who wrote a book many, many years ago, A Grace Disguised, after he was in a car accident being hit by a drunk driver. And in that one accident, he lost three generations. His mother was killed, his wife was killed, and his daughter was killed. And he walked away without a scratch somehow. And he had to live with that pain. And then he wrote this book, A Grace Disguised. You see the cover of it in case you were interested in reading it. It's about loss. How do you grieve? How do you live after a time of significant loss? But one thing he said in the book I thought was very interesting. He says, "The experience of loss does not need to be the defining moment of our story. The defining moment can be our response to the loss. It's not that we're defined by the loss. We ought to be defined by how we respond to what God has allowed in that loss." Isn't that the testimony of the Spafford who wrote, "It is well with my soul"? You consider your life right now. Are you being defined by some of the negative things that have come in your life that that you didn't expect, you didn't want, but God has allowed? Or are you being defined more by your trust in Him, the hope that He gives, and knowing that your response will lead you to greater things? Let's go on through the story. Naomi's life is not about loss. It's about redemption. A great redeemer. Well, once Ruth and Naomi arrive in Bethlehem, Ruth goes into the fields and begins to pick up the grain left by the farmers there. A welfare system they had was that as they were collecting the grain in harvest time, if there was anything that was dropped or left, they weren't to go back and pick those up. Just leave those for the poor and those who were in need, that they would come along and collect the leftovers. As you're going through, just be generous enough to leave some things. So Ruth goes out to gather some grain so that just her and her mother-in-law can survive. They'd have enough food to eat. Well, she's going through this process of doing this every day, and then she ends up collecting some in a very unique place. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 3, she's collecting on the field of Boaz, and it says this in the chapter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field. That's what's called gleaning, catching the extras. Gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, which was of the clan of Elimelech. Just happens to. Now, I underline that specifically. I don't know what it says in your translation. I'm using the English Standard Version. But just, she happened to. I read that and go, just coincidentally. She just happened to stumble upon it accidentally. No, she just didn't happen to. God led her to the very field that is owned by Boaz, who happens to be a family member of Elimelech, her father-in-law. This will make more sense in just a few moments if you're not familiar with the story. You know, there are no coincidences in God's plan for you. At this time, Boaz notices Ruth. Boaz likes Ruth. He befriends her. And when Naomi finds out about Ruth connected to Boaz, in chapter 2, verse 3, and 4, it says, "Wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor and do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking, but when he lies down, otherwise, or observe the place where he lies, and then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." I want to use the Living Bible, which is a paraphrase. A man just used the Bible and wrote it down in ways that his grandchildren could understand. So I want to use the Living Bible to express what's happening here. Verse 8, Ruth chapter 3, verse 8. Suddenly around midnight, she's going and she's doing exactly what her mother-in-law told her to do. So suddenly around midnight, she's laying there. Ruth is laying at his feet, which was an odd custom, by the way. But I want you to explain this. As Naomi realized that that Ruth was connected to Boaz in the field, and Boaz is interested. In their culture, they have something called a kinsman redeemer, okay? A guardian redeemer is another term sometimes used. If a man dies, and he has property and family, the property would need to be sold to someone else unless there was someone in the family willing to take responsibility for that property and the family. Now, it was at a huge cost sometimes. Your relative dies, and you're supposed to not only take the property, say, oh, it's great, I get the property. Oh, but you get the mother-in-law, you get all the children. You're responsible for providing for them. So many times, even in this culture, they wouldn't take that risk. They would just let it be sold. It's not my problem. I'm sorry, my uncle died, but I'm not going to pay his debt. I'm not going to take care of his responsibilities. All right, but Naomi knew that Boaz was a godly man. It says, you know, if you'll go, he's a relative. If you'll go and sit with him, he may desire to be your redeemer, to, as a kinsman, as a guardian, he may protect and provide for us through this means. So suddenly around midnight, as she's laying there hoping that Boaz would treat her right, suddenly around midnight, he awakened and sat up startled. Would you sit up startled if some young woman was sitting at your feet in the middle of the night, you woke up and didn't know it was there? There was a woman lying at his feet. Verse 9. "Who are you?" he demanded. "It's I, sir, Ruth," she replied. "Make me your wife according to God's law, the kinsman redeemer law, for you are my close relative." Verse 10. "Thank God for a girl like you." Ken Taylor wrote this for his grandchildren out of Scripture. I just love how he phrases it here. "Thank God for a girl like you," he exclaimed, "for you are being even kinder to Naomi now than before. Naturally, you'd prefer a younger man, even though poor, but you have put aside your personal desires. You're looking for a gift that God would provide, not just what you would design for your own life." That's pretty significant. Verse 11, he goes on, "Now don't worry about a thing. My child, I'll handle all the details, for everyone knows what a wonderful person you are." So Boaz says, "Yes, I will marry you." Now, unfortunately, there was another closer relative that could stand in the gap and be the kinsman redeemer. You can read more about that in later chapter 4. Boaz lets the individual know, okay, hey, look, you know, Elimelech died. You're actually the closest redeemer. You can get the land. Oh, and by the way, there's a mother you have to take care of. There's a foreign woman, you know, from somewhere else. I mean, she'll be part of the deal. You just have to be responsible for all of them. The guy says, basically, "No, I'm not interested." And Boaz is like, "Yes, because I already have my heart set on her." And so he ends up marrying her. That's a good word. The end of the story was not loss, but redemption. It's a great story if you understand the whole of what God is doing in their lives. In verse 4, or chapter 4, verse 13, skip ahead a little bit. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. I'm skipping a little portion here. You can read your own verse, but there's an intentionality of why I didn't put that in here for all ages. And then the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. His name was Obed. And Obed had a son later on named Jesse. And Jesse had a son named David. And David was King David. Now I want to show you some beautiful things about the story as we get to the conclusion of this. She had opened her box. I'm going to go back to Naomi and Ruth in the land of Moab. They opened the box, and it wasn't what they were expecting. But they just saw the top of the box. They didn't get to dig down deep yet. The more they were looking at what God had in store, wasn't at the top what they were wanting, but then they kept digging in. They found redemption through Christ, though they didn't even know that they were going to be a part of the Christ birth story. Does anybody know who the mother of Boaz is? Rahab. If you remember when the Israelites were coming across and they were going to go across the Jordan into Jericho, and they were going to march around and blow their little trumpets and all, and the wells are going to come down and they're going to begin to enter the promised land. Well, when the spies went in, they found this woman named Rahab, who was a prostitute. She was of a foreign land, a foreign culture, did not worship the God of the Israelites. But in that, God transformed her heart, helped her to become a believer in him, and she joined the Israelites in their faith. God redeemed Rahab. Is there any wonder now why Boaz might be open to receiving a foreign woman to see what God would do with her? That's where my mom was redeemed from, and now I'll take a wife. If you look in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, the long list of Jesus' lineage, it starts in Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab, and Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David, the king. And then later, if you continue to read, you get to the end where it then says in verse 16, "And Jacob, the father of Joseph, and husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Christ." These two women, there are only four women listed in the genealogy of Jesus, and two of them are related to Boaz. One's a mother and one's a wife. God can redeem anybody out of any circumstance and make him a part of his family for something more glorious than you can see on your own. Isn't that a good word? God's still in the redeeming business. Just because you open your box and the first couple papers you see, the first little thing you see, don't think that that's it. Keep digging and see what God has for you. You keep trusting and knowing that He is the hope, the only hope that you have. No matter what's taking place in your life, no matter what difficulties, God is the God of hope. And this Christmas, I wanted to remind you that no matter the season you're in, don't be defined by loss. Be defined by your response to the God of hope in the midst of your loss. As we conclude today, I want to pray in just a few moments and we'll be receiving our offering. I've got a friend that's going to share with you about the Gideons. His name's Kelly, and I want you to receive him in just a second. Kelly works with the Gideons. He's a speaker. He's not a professional preacher. He's a contributor, a leader in the Gideon organization. How many of you have ever been to a place where you've seen a Gideon Bible in the hotels or whatever? Yeah, you know how important this ministry is. Would you welcome Kelly to come share with us? As he's walking up, let me pray for our offering, and I'll pray for Kelly. Father, thank you for your story of hope and redemption and grace. And Father, I pray that you would touch the hearts of every person here, that they would not leave this place without seeking out myself or one of our prayer counselors in a few moments or somebody at the information table to get their life right with Jesus and receive the hope and grace they need. Now, I pray for my brother Kelly as he shares about the work of the ministry of the Gideons and how can we as individuals participate in that ministry. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.